Thank you, comrades, and welcome. I'm very happy to see there's so many other socialists here who are willing to out themselves as perfectly comfortable enjoying the most depraved and morally abhorrent aspects of popular culture. You don't need to worry. This room, for as long as the session is going on, is going to be a safe space for all left-wing enthusiasts. So to anyone who's ever been gripped by an irrepressible giddiness while evaluating whether a kill sequence was any good or not, but then came to your senses and saw that your shirt was soaked in the red, bloody guck of political guilt, I want to say to you that you're seen. I too suffer from this affliction, and I feel that kind of inner turmoil that comes with delighting in mounting body counts, secretly rooting for every mass murderer in a mask in every schlocky 80s horror movie, and all the other carnivalistic revelry and guts and gore that we know is somewhat depraved, but we can't look away from. That's the kind of context, and those are some of the problems that we're going to be dealing with. Which means, safe space or not, we should really ask ourselves, does this enthusiasm make us bad socialists? Should we enroll in 12-step re-education programs and overcome our petty bourgeois tastes? Do we need to recognize that the high watermark of all culture in the 20th century was Warren Beatty's Reds and move on? Not to spoil the ending, but I think that the answer to all of the above should be a blood-curdling no. And in fact, I'm going to make the case that there's much for radicals of all stripes to learn from horror movies, and also make the case that whether you're skeptical of this or not, there's a lot for us to defend. And I can see all the raised eyebrows out there, so you're skeptical of what I'm kind of going for. It's one thing to accept these things as a kind of guilty pleasure, but defend them? This seems absurd. To which I say, if others can try and politically defend the West Wing, I'm gonna try to politically defend Saw. Only the first one, though. Sequels, not so much. I will concede that those objections are onto something, not with the readings of the West Wing, but the skepticism. Because after all, as philosophical materialists on the one hand, and radical social critics on the other, what business do Marxists have lauding a genre that's widely known for its lazy reflection and at worst outright endorsement of the most vile and reactionary aspects of our culture? The hideous underbelly is always on display inside of horror movies, but I think it's not just that. The severed head does roll left on occasion, and that should help socialists bury our guilt about indulging our desire to scare ourselves silly. And I'm gonna get into some of that a little bit later, but there's a reason for us to pay attention that's even more important than seeking obvious outliers and exceptions to the rule. More important than our quest to silence the moralistic critics of our tastes is the fact that there's no such thing as a politically neutral nightmare. And we need to learn from them. Because their ability to function requires horror movies to plumb the depths of a society's deepest fears, the throbbing heart buried beneath the floorboards of every terrifying tale, regardless of its political inflection, offers us really invaluable political insights. As China Miéville put it in his sixth thesis on monsters, epics throw up the monsters they need. History can be written of monsters and in them. We experience the conjunction of certain werewolves and crisis-gnawed feudalism, of Cthulhu and rupturing modernity, of Frankenstein's and Moreau's made things and a variably troubled enlightenment, of vampires and tediously everything, of zombies and mummies and aliens and golems slash robots slash clockwork constructs and their own anxieties. We pass through the endless shift of such monstrous germs and antigens into new wounds. All our moments are monstrous moments. In other words, the history of all hitherto existing societies is the history of monsters. From their literary birth down to the present, monsters of all sorts have always screamed for audiences to recognize that they mean something. And we've excitedly rushed to answer those howling pleas. If you just listen to the chatter outside of the hallways of even the most shallow, big-budget monster movies, you'll see what I mean. What does that nightmare clown represent? No, Godzilla is not about nuclear war. It's about climate catastrophe. What the hell were the rabbits about? and so on. Yes. This elusive polysemy, this imitation to interpretation, is one of the first pillars the left should raise in defense of horror to court. The genre is a radically democratic one, in the way that it spills its hot and stinking guts all over the screen and asks us to sift through the entrails. Every successful work of horror, be it film or fiction, relies on its ability to tap into deeply ingrained social anxieties and uses them to conjure, with the help of blood-soaked garbs and lots of latex, those nightmares that lurk just below the surface of our conscious minds. And as a result, everybody has something to take away from them. If you're scared by a horror movie, you invariably want to figure out why and have conversations about it, and therefore, you're part of the process of the whole thing making the whole thing working. The horrible forms that stalk around whenever reason slumbers can teach us about ourselves and our society. So, to sink our teeth into the neck of this talk and begin draining its sanguineous substance, I think we should get started with a little bit of teratology by way of decoding the political anxieties that dwell beneath some of Hollywood's most famous horror films. But we should tread carefully here. While every 9/11-shaped wound and every phallus-tongued xenomorph begs to be violently desiccated by our decoding, we should also bear in mind that total domestication is definitionally impossible when dealing with the ineffable, of which monsters are one such. The creature's toothy maw might be a metaphor for the perils of sex, but we forget that it's also filled with razor-sharp teeth at our own peril. We need to respect our quarry in addition to being enthralled by it. So three quick notes before taking a stroll down memory lane. First, I'm going to be playing really fast and loose here, so expect overgeneralization, simplifications, and probably a couple of spoilers. I promise they will not be from the last decade. Boo, hiss, I get it. Second, of course I know that horror is about a lot more than just monsters. We'll even talk about some ghosts when we get into the 2000s. But the basic point remains the same. When we peel back the flesh on what grants a given story the ability to make us scream, we invariably find more than just our personal trauma staring back at us. Third, because it's both more interesting and more accessible, I'll spend a lot more time on our contemporary moment than those that came before it. Right. So, cinema as a form developed into something a little bit more than a carnival trick at the turn of the 20th century, but it really took off during the interwar years. Horror movies, specifically monster movies, were there from the very beginning and were central to winning a mass appeal. Nosferatu, arguably one of the most famous films of the era in any genre, was released in 1922, and it wasn't long before its cloaked villain, Count Orlok, was joined by a menagerie of other now classic entities. Dracula, Frankenstein's monster, the Wolfman, the Mummy, all of these became household names in the 30s and 40s. And the appeal of these creature features, I think, was immediate and spoke to Depression-era audiences on two different levels. First was that they were all big-budget spectacles starring the most widely known actors of their time. Lon Chaney, Bela Lugosi, and Boris Karloff were basically the Christian Bale and the Dwayne The Rock Johnson of the contemporary moment. And Universal Studios spared no expense at wheeling out new special effects and makeup artists and all the sorts of things that you would get in effectively the equivalent of a major CGI markup that today's audiences are familiar with. So these movies did the spectacle, and they also offered viewers a metaphoric route towards confronting their mundane but paralyzing fears. From unemployment, the creeping threat of fascism, and the looming shadows of war. For 70 to 90 minutes, they sat in those crowded theaters and their minds didn't have to deal with the real world, even though they were staring at the real world underneath lots and lots of makeup, whether they realized it or not. Then, in the 1950s, the radioactive fallout from Hiroshima and Nagasaki mutated and made giant everything from leeches to women, while aliens, i.e. communists, infiltrated bucolic communities in lots all over Hollywood to put law-abiding white Americans into pods. Hitchcock sowed the seeds that would become the slasher subgenre with Psycho in 1960, becoming a sensation in part because of the way it tapped into rampant sexual repression in the era. and every American era, really. Norman Bates, as a figure, really offered viewers the opportunity to simultaneously indulge their own voyeurism while also maintaining a safe distance from which to condemn the way that he acted on those impulses. We, of course, would never so much as fantasize about the things he actually did. This dynamic inside of horror, I think, is very important for a lot of the kind of subtext that's going on throughout, and Hitchcock captured it in a way that I think is really important and essential to the success, as I said. But where things really start getting interesting for those on the left is in the 60s and the early 70s, when the political winds of those decades start blowing through the horror genre. With the war in Vietnam raging in the background of every news broadcast, and images of police dogs being unleashed on civil rights protesters beamed directly into every TV screen, a new crop of young, talented, and very political directors took to the horror genre to revolt against the casualized violence of American society. The revolution began in 1968, both in the streets and in George Romero's Night of the Living Dead, in which a group of humans took shelter from hordes of reanimated corpses, only to discover that their own insecurities and prejudices were probably more dangerous than the ghouls that were pursuing them. This point is driven home when a group of police and other well-armed men promptly shoot the protagonist at the end of the movie, drag him over the threshold by meat hooks, throw his body onto a funeral pyre with other recently dispatched zombies. And the fact that said protagonist, Ben, was played by Dwayne Jones, a black actor, makes this final sequence feel hauntingly like a lynching. There's just no way to look at it and not see the images of the Klan and various other far-right elements that targeted black people all across this country as the backdrop to this. And the same kind of resonance was taken up in The Last House on the Left, which was Wes Craven's first feature film, even though his approach was much more literal than George Romero's. In the first half of the movie, a teenage girl and her friend are brutally gang-raped and murdered by a group of recently escaped criminals. Craven dispenses with all the sterilizing gauze of symbolism and implied violence and just has the camera trained on every deprived moment of the gore, and it's grisly. Watching it is one of the most difficult things that you'll experience. And in the second half, the perpetrators, whose obvious sadism and moral degeneracy we witnessed in the first half of the movie, are themselves subjected to equally degrading and torturous acts at the hands of one of the murdered girl's completely unremarkable middle-class parents. They're your standard suburban-dwelling normal people, supposedly. And if there ever were a righteousness to be found in revenge, surely this would be it. The revenge fantasy that actually directly confronts the perpetrators of one of the most heinous acts of violence you can imagine. But with Craven at the helm, the violence of those bereaved parents is just as disturbing as the violence of the supposed sociopaths, which is much of his point. Every single night, American society is watching images of napalm drenching Vietnamese cities without batting an eyelash. So he decides to force audiences to sit through and for some reason deal more personally with the experiences on the screen than they would with the newsreels. And the effect is really palpable. It was a commercial success, partly because it cost almost nothing to make and grossed about $3 million. But Craven was turned into effectively a pariah for almost a decade without, couldn't get work, so on and so forth. There's just too, for high society, it wasn't acceptable. The third, I think, important director from that same era of a left-wing bent is John Carpenter, who, in a lot of ways, started the 1980s early when he burst onto the scene in 1978 with arguably the greatest slasher movie of all time, Halloween. And I'm correct about this, if anybody disagrees. In a lot of ways, this movie defined Reagan-era horror by starting the career of America's favorite scream queen, Jamie Lee Curtis, and reintroducing an element of the fantastic to the genre by making Michael Myers' expressionless, chalk-white face, making his form more a force of nature than a human being, whereas most of the other slashers that were happening at the time were run-of-the-mill serial killers who were very much human. Michael Myers is an entity that I won't go into the explication of the film for lack of time, but most people, I imagine, will have seen it. And then there's John Carpenter's score, which is reason enough to watch anything that he's ever done. excellent. Following Halloween, Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street were hugely successful, and they carved out an extremely lucrative mold from which clones are still cast to this day. You take Teenagers in Peril, otherworldly and or preternatural but human-shaped monsters, swirl in a random sampling of 5 to 10 established tropes, and you've got a commercially viable and occasionally delightful scare fest. Who cares if the knockoffs have about as much substance as circus peanuts do nutrition? As in the rest of society at the time, there's a deep conservatism that reigns in most of the other offerings from the 1980s. Every slumber party massacre and sorority house massacre and graduation day massacre were mostly cleverly disguised excuses to cut up women, preferably scantily clad women, and they substituted moralism for their plot. The basic takeaway was always and everywhere, having extramarital sex guarantees you're going to get murdered. Full stop, nothing else to see here. Cut up a couple of women, go home. I have more to say about, I skipped a bit. I will have more too. While the sequels to all three of those movies I mentioned, Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street, and Halloween, and we can agree there were way too many of the sequels, it should have stopped. While all of them eventually signed on to that same kind of right-wing sex panic and offered up moralistic takes of their own, I think the originals are all very left-wing, or at least very left-curious, in kind of explicit terms. And I have a lot more to say about those that I'll take up in my Monsters Against Moralism section. But I want to hurry through dismembering the rest of the timeline. The one thing I will say here in the context of the 1980s that is quite interesting is that there are more than a few feminist arguments that the 1970s and 1980s actually were among the heydays of feminist horror making. Specifically reading them as empowering because of the position of women within the narratives, that you actually had actors getting jobs, female actors getting jobs that wouldn't otherwise, so on and so forth. There's a great book called Men, Women, and Chainsaws that folks should scope out. It's out of print, so you've got to get it online, but it's very, very good. On to the 90s, we get postmodern horror in a lot of ways, where our monsters lashed out at themselves. Wes Craven led the way with this in both Wes Craven's A New Nightmare, in which Freddy Krueger starts haunting Robert Englund and killing people who were close to Wes Craven, and then Saw a couple of years later because people didn't get the joke, so he made the same movie but in a different form. Both of them were great, really worth watching, but he just was really at it. Those are the most notable meta-horror from that period, and I think that the Blair Witch Project at the end of the decade really tilted things back in the direction of hauntings, and it spawned a craze for the kind of Japanese and Korean ghost stories that people are familiar with in the form of The Ring and The Grudge and so on. It also spawned the found footage genre, which didn't really exist before that and now is everywhere. Much of it very, very bad. Some of it's great, but a lot of it's really, really bad. And I think that the central problem or the central like anxiety at the heart of a lot of these hauntings is people in the midst of just total crisis, their lives falling to pieces, and then there also happens to be a spirit that's going to make it all worse. Hooray for that. Though that lurch towards the supernatural, though, I think was temporarily interrupted or at least complicated by 9/11 and the Iraq War. Which gave us torture porn and the unfortunate career of Eli Roth. It was just a flat reflection of everything that was happening in the world. If The Last House on the Left and the kind of 1970s revolt against the Vietnam War was about presenting people with violence in such a way that they couldn't avoid it, torture porn, particularly in Eli Roth's hands, was nothing but a celebration of the fact America was back on top, could do it, and let's go after those stupid European tourists or whatever it may be. They're getting what's coming to them. And that kind of rah-rah patriotism, I think you can see in a lot of these movies, from Wolf Creek to all sorts of things. Happy to talk more about it. And I think that torture porn gets a bit of a bad rap on the left because I think it can do more than just that. Annalee Newitz, who was the editor at IO9, wrote a really interesting review of The Human Centipede, which is kind of torture porn par excellence. It's a movie birthed of the idea, what would happen if you sewed the mouth of one person to the ass of another one? that's all the movie is. And it has the answer to you. Naomi Newitz reads it as a really transgressive body horror that is quite important for thinking gender, identity, all sorts of things. Quite a good read. I'm not convinced, but there's something there. So anyway, there are always political poles within each of these kind of genres that end up happening. Either way, torture porn, mostly about 9/11 and the Iraq War in magazine. The Naughties also resurrected zombies and vampires in a huge way, but lots of other people have talked about that enough that I don't feel like I need to. If folks want to have a conversation about The Walking Dead, let's do it, that's okay, but, you know, every graduate thesis that's been published in the last 20 years in this field probably talks about it. Just go with those. And we also published a book at Haymarket that can help you with this as well. David McNally's The Monsters in the Market, which deals with vampires, zombies, and the development of the tropes over the course of the economic history of capitalism. So read that one. So on to the current moment, effectively. And I think that the current moment, interestingly, is really created, or at least brought into being by James Wan, who also was responsible for the beginnings of torture porn. Saw, directed and written by James Wan, is the first of these kind of like bodily dismemberment movies that revel in a kind of, I made that case already. He makes the movie The Conjuring in 2013, and I think following that, it's just impossible for any of the previous iteration of the mainstream of horror to get any traction. Famously, Eli Roth, to keep beating up on him, his movie The Green Inferno like languishes for years. Because the moment has moved, nobody wants to produce it. He wants to show everybody why Occupy is filled with a bunch of whining ingrates and makes a cannibalistic horror movie about it that comes out in 2017, I think. A little bit late. Because everything has shifted and it's just no longer the case that people were interested in those sorts of things. And I think Juan understood that, and so it makes a very, very different movie that opens the door to what I'd say is the golden era of horror. Like, I don't think there's ever been a better time to be a horror enthusiast, both in the mainstream and on the fringes of the indie world. We're getting some of the most interesting and effective horror that's been produced, I think, in quite a long time. We don't get the respect that we deserve. For anybody who saw Hereditary last year, the fact that Toni Collette wasn't nominated for an Oscar is just a travesty. For an off-screen howl of anguish to be that effective without seeing anything about her body. Anyway, very, very good. We should talk more about it. So formally speaking, I think that we're getting some of the best stuff that's on offer. But I also think that politically, there's more to the current moment than we've seen for some time as well. So for socialists who like a culture served up with plenty of puncture wounds and gnashing teeth, we can feel even more at home in the current moment where the politics are decisively anti-moralist. And I think that this is quite important. And they deal with honest attempts to grapple. They are an attempt to honestly grapple with trauma in various forms without offering any kind of easy outs that you'll find in a lot of the other horror movies that have come before. So, now, as I alluded to above, because of the hegemony within horror for more than a generation of moralism, which I'd say in the context of horror means the kind of unthinking, conservative denunciation of transgressions from the prevailing social norms that usually feature a counterposition of a kind of idealized purity to a deranged slash unacceptable slash variously wrong foil. That to me is the essence of horror's understanding of moralism. This given has come under really sustained assault as of late and from within. I think that the best of today's horror movies are actually attacking this poisonous ideological pillar of the ruling order, which is no less toxic in its left form, it should be said. And they're doing it more effectively than a lot of the left are. I'll get into that a little bit more later, but I think it's important also to just jump back and recognize that those specific directors that I talked about from the 70s and 80s were in a lot of ways, even if their critiques wound up muted or were left abandoned later on, were in the vanguard of kind of confronting this and recognizing that it was a blockage preventing horror from connecting in the way that it could have. Wes Craven's on record as turning explicitly turning to horror as an artistic protest against Vietnam, and Sean Cunningham, who was the producer on Last House on the Left and the director of Friday the 13th, has shared similar views. And then if you watch John Carpenter's They Live, you don't need to go further to witness his radical bona fides. These are like explicitly left-wing horror directors. But their stated views, I think, are only half of what is important. After all, artists often have the least access to the political fault lines that they're touching on, death of the author and all that. But each of the films that they're most famous for, I think, are deeply subversive at their core and directly challenging that kind of hectoring purity. And I'll go through some of that. First is Friday the 13th, which on the face of it seems like it just plays into the same kind of campy revelry at the altar of moral purity that you would have. Teenagers, often ones who are engaged in sexual activity before marriage, wind up murdered by a knife glove wielding maniac who haunts their dreams. But I think the key to understanding this movie in particular is like one small sequence in which Nancy, the main protagonist's mother, goes on this tirade about Freddy Krueger's background. Freddy Krueger, of course, is this alluded to monster. Hopefully people know that. She talks about how he was a dirty child molester who was abusing children all across the neighborhood, who got off because a hotshot lawyer was able to plead his case against a fat cat judge who was getting rich off of the system. And it's just all of this, like, this is interesting. This is not exactly a left-wing understanding of what justice even within the context of Capitol Room could be. And the ringer is, therefore we took it into our own hands, we burned his house down, we murdered him. So the mob of parents who are bereaved, presumably there's real things that are happening, maybe not, who knows, go and find their neighbor who they're convinced is responsible for these horrible things happening, string him up by his haunches, and then he comes back as a vengeful spirit and murders their children. It's not a straightforward moral purity thing there. There's at least a bit of complication in an attempt to try and say these monsters that lurk beneath the bed literally in suburbia probably have a reason and probably are generated by the people who live in those communities, not from without, not so on and so forth. That's, I think, a reading. In sequels, when they show you the actual so-called actual history of Freddy Krueger, I hold that the first was true and they're just revisionists later. They get rid of all of this and make him he of course was responsible, because you can't deal with anything that's complicated once you get into making dozens of sequels. And in Friday the 13th, I think a similar kind of anti-moralism creeps just below the surface if you examine it a little bit further. True to form, all of the sequels of Friday the 13th basically establish that summer camp, teens bad, etc. trope. But it's important to remember in the first one, there is no Jason Voorhees, the reanimated corpse or whatever monster he is. There's only Mrs. Voorhees, who's wearing a hockey mask and murdering campers because she thinks her son died as a result of their negligence. She's decided that they were off canoodling somewhere, and that's why her son died. She goes to the summer camp and starts murdering her. This is not a normal reaction. It's not a thing you should do. There's no attempt to try and say that this is the hero of that story. And there similarly is like one very small sequence in which it's very clear that she's in the midst of a like grief-stricken breakdown where she's not acting rationally, and there's a kind of difficulty in dealing with that, but nonetheless it's a part of the movie that gets flattened later on, and certainly is not in Michael Bay's remakes and any of that stuff. So these challenges to the prevailing mood are, I think, quite important. And even though those elements are understated, they're there. Understatement is not the kind of thing that you get around these questions in the current crop of movies that I feel like are the important ones doing the kind of political work I'm referring to. Jennifer Kent's The Babadook and the aforementioned Hereditary are the most exemplary, but these movies just totally eschew neat answers to crippling, impossible thematic questions. The Babadook is a monster movie about a single mother who, in a lot of ways, hates her kid. because he's destroying her life, he's impossible, he is everything that the monster becomes in symbolic form. And in the course of the movie, there's a flip. I said no spoilers in the last decade, so I won't go further than that. But the core of the movie, is this grappling with familial trauma and a recognition that actually, maybe it's okay. Part of the problem is that it's not possible for her to admit that it's actually hard to be a single mother, and she maybe doesn't want to do it. She doesn't have an exit. There's no way around it. Still a kid. That's the kind of heart of it. And I think Hereditary does the same kind of a thing. Confronts a situation that there's literally no way that you can possibly deal with as far as the grief that the family's subjected to. And then all of the most effective sequences throughout the movie are not when there is a cult or a spirit or a monster. It's sitting around the dinner table and arguing about this paralyzing familial trauma that they've all shared. And it's just, it makes your skin crawl and you want to like walk out because of that. And then she also is on the ceiling and beating her head against the attic door. So just both of these things, of course. And I think that this refusal to say that we have a quick answer to these things that everybody faces and yet won't talk about or can't talk about, whatever it may be, refusing to make the easy answers is both politically more interesting and I think makes for scarier filmmaking. It's like, these are some of those terrifying movies that I've seen in quite a long while. And isn't it more interesting when our sympathies are divided or contradictory, right? Like, this is part of what I was after in terms of the monsters being the key to unlocking so much. It's always been the case that you simultaneously recognize that Kong, as he smashes and rends and steals the blonde beauty or whatever it may be, that that's the villain, yet you also weep when the monster is destroyed, when he falls from the tower, when, you know, famously the creature from the Black Lagoon doesn't get what it's after. There's an identification there that I think is really important and that we should really always hold on to. And I think Kong actually, on a political level, does even more work than that with what it represents symbolically, right? If you rewatch the original movies, they are deeply racist. Not just in terms of the portrayal of the indigenous people on the island, which is as bad as you could imagine, but also in that everything about the movie and what the ape represents clearly is riffing on the kind of paranoia about black men's sexuality. And that's the subtext, the like anxiety-inducing component of the monster's power. And yet, still you identify, and still he's the hero, still you want him to smash the airplanes out of the sky. And it's a kind of situation similar to what Blake refers to in Milton's identification with the Company of Hell. You can't but end up attached to these monsters because they represent ourselves and everything that we're trying to repress but incapable of. This, I think, is like quite interesting. And then the last thing I'll say about this divided sympathies and contradictory things is a movie like The Neon Demon. I don't know if other people have seen it. It was Nicholas Winding Refn who did Drive. It's a really troubling film that I've seen a couple of times now, and I'm genuinely not sure whether it is a feminist excoriation of everything to do with Hollywood and the kind of culture of beauty there, or it's simple exploitation. And it's not like facile. It's not like, he's cleverly trying to do both. I honestly do not know. Whether this is something that I should excoriate and, you know, condemn, or it's worthy of direct praise. If others have opinions, I'd love to hear them, because I'm asking for help. Which starts to get at one of the other, I think, really important political points in the way that we approach these things, which is to say that, one, it's always true that culture is mediated by the political forces at the time and the arguments that one can lodge in favor of claiming them or rejecting them, but also that it's contested necessarily because of that mediation. One of the things that I found fascinating in doing the research for this talk, I just enumerated some of the people I think are the most left-wing directors from the 1980s, And when I was doing a little Googling, like, what do conservatives think about these movies? Their top 10 lists of best conservative movies of the decade are the same ones I put on my list for the top 10 left-wing films. They have different reasons. Again, they're wrong. We're wrong. But it's not nothing. And if there's a reason for us to care beyond just wanting to recognize the need to access something primal about the fears that move us and the monsters that lurk beneath society, it's also that the right wing very much cares about this. They get quite invested in whether or not Michael Myers is a white nationalist. We don't have a dog in that fight. We shouldn't say that he's a warrior for social liberation. He's not. But that there's such investment in trying to say that the social conservatism of these movies is what's really driving people to care about them, we should challenge. We should actually say it's not just that. And the place that I'll wrap up is on the current moment, in that mediation and in the need to try and think about the way that these things are contested. I feel like the secondary part of this, and it's a refrain that hopefully people hear a lot and think about a lot, is how we need to be quite critical of the things that we love. There is a very bad tendency among the left to do a kind of sloppy justification of what we like, some of which I've done in this talk already, because I love these movies and therefore I will defend them on that basis. Hopefully there's more to it than that, but we can't just try and grasp after the political defenses based on the one marginal reading of one small conversation that Nancy's mom has with her. There's gotta be more to it. And I think the closer we get to things that are politically proximal to what we would actually identify with, the more critical we should be. Because we should have higher standards. We should actually say, if you're attempting to try and do politics with your movies, or with your books, or whatever it may be, take you seriously, accept that, be more rigorous, be more effective. And so, my maybe spiciest take that I hope people will push back on is Jordan Peele. I think there's a lot of what he's doing that's amazing. And I think it's very unique in the context of where horror is and where it's been. Most specifically, both Get Out and Us are channeling the kind of fears and anxieties of middle-class black people in a way that I don't think any horror director's ever tried to do. And what I mean by that, one, Us, I think it's more pronounced. Us, in a lot of ways, is formally speaking a home invasion movie that's always been about suburbia, the picket fences, the purity, the virginal daughter, and so on and so forth. These kind of deeply conservative elements where somebody is threatening it, defend your house. And the absurd part of every home invasion movie is, why the fuck don't you leave? Okay, these people want your stuff. Who cares? Flee! And in the context of Us, it's exactly what happens, right? That's a small spoiler, apologies. It's only the first half hour, so I'm going too far. But like, that's just not the starting point for what actually makes the family at the heart of Us tick. Instead, what it's about is an imposter syndrome, a feeling that everything they've got is the result of somebody else not getting it, and that they're undeserving, which I feel like is much more at the kind of center of the like middle-class black psyche, as opposed to the white middle-class psyche that's about their stuff and all the rest of it. And that's why the core of the horror, what drives the anxiety and dread in those movies, is different than anything else that's been made. And this, I think, is worth commending and is very interesting. And I think a lot of people don't actually get it. Which is a sidebar, is not to say he's incredibly unique in dealing with racism or thinking about the ways in which our society is especially brutal towards marginalized people, any of this. I already mentioned Romero, but to use Wes Craven as my go-to on everything, I guess, a movie like The People Under the Stairs in 1991 does a lot of the same sorts of things that Jordan Peele is attempting to do. If people haven't seen it, it's worth checking out. It's very strange. But also a very, very good movie that stars black protagonists, that is set in a black neighborhood, that is about gentrification, racism, and the dispossession of the community, and the weirdos who are responsible for it. So it's been done, but it's still Jordan Peele's doing it in a way that's different. So maybe this is a small distinction, but lots of the critical acclaim that he's gotten, I feel like, has been slightly off. And it feels somewhat as if it's an attempt of the mainstream to say, oh, this guy is great. He's better than anybody else. I prickle at this. We also have others who are worth paying attention to. He is good. He's of our company, not exemplary as opposed to, or not standing above it, if that makes some sense. So that stuff that he's doing is really amazing. And as I said, lots of other people are getting things wrong about what he's doing. That's really good. But I think that on the whole, I felt like Us doesn't actually live up to the hype if what you're looking for is a horror movie that's effective at scaring some of its taste, some of its what people are going to be after when they're going into the theater. But it falls to pieces in trying to explain its own, to justify its own, where are its monsters from, what are they doing. He can't leave well enough alone. And I think even more so, he gets in the way of himself of not knowing whether he's making a horror comedy or if he's making something that's just a straight horror movie. Again, these may be taste issues, but wanted to throw it out there so people can denounce me for something. So, I should wrap up there, and just in sum, to think about what are our takeaways. Lots of things to discuss. I'd love to hear people's takes on what are particularly left-wing examples within the genre. Even more interesting in a lot of ways, what are the especially right-wing contributions that actually are effective and do things that are interesting, challenging, and worth defending. I had hoped to talk about some of that stuff, and I didn't have the time because I went too long on talking about how great Wes Craven is, I guess. And then the final thing to sum up is that I think we should also always keep in mind that this is not where we do politics, right? The stakes are relatively low. This is not a world-ending conflict. It's not a thing that's going to make or break the path to socialist revolution, but it is a battlefield, right? We can't just concede that the cultural landscape is one we shouldn't care about, since the class struggle is not going to be made or broken here. And I think it's an important one for the reasons that I said at the start, that horror in particular just has an access to the dirty underbelly that connects with everybody. And the fears that are driving folks, the popular horror tells you something about what is motivating people at the most base level. Not directly. It takes a little bit of time to figure out what's actually going on there, but we should take it seriously. So to close with a slogan, I want to say, down with moralism and up with the monsters.